Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin.
And I'm Varsha.
And today on the pod, we are going to be talking about another horrific story that has to do with the kids at the border and the whole family separation mess. We're going to talk about Kavanaugh and a couple of bizarre press conferences that Trump has held. And that says nothing of the fact that he's done two press conferences in a week when he's done that many in the entire time he was president before this past week. So it's a weird fucking week. And I was just talking to Varsha before we started recording. It really has taken the wind out of my sails.
Yeah, it's been a lot for me. Like, I've never actually, like, I'm thinking back to other horrible weeks during this presidency. And I feel like number one that takes the cake was the first couple weeks with the Muslim ban. I don't know. I remember the fear and the horror and like the dread every morning. And I think the second week was like the Charlottesville, you know? And then a third week is probably when the children separations at the border just like took off. And this has been like another one.
Yeah, I think for me, you know, I think Charlottesville and the Muslim ban were both really enraging weeks. When they were trying to repeal ACA.
Oh, yeah.
That was a really hard one. I think my number one toughest week was when we learned about family separation at the border. I couldn't sleep. I cried. I mean, that was really bad. But, you know, the thing is with all these other weeks and all these other stories, like, rage. There was so much rage. There was crying and despair, but also rage. And I hate to admit this, but this week, like, the rage hasn't come yet. Like, I'm still just sad, and I'm still just so displaced by everything that's going on.
I know they tell you, like, despair is what, like, the enemy wants. You should just stay angry. But it's hard sometimes. And so I encourage people listening to, like, do whatever self-care you need to get back to your rage, or get back to whatever normal is for you in 2018. Because, like, the despair can take over. And it's tough to get out of.
It really is. I mean, like I said, the rage just hasn't come yet. It will come. And it will, you know, I will come out of this more galvanized than before. But, you know, I think I just want everyone listening to know that this is just as difficult for me, and I know for Varsha, and for, you know, so many people who are connecting to this story, all of these stories, and the fatigue that comes with this never ending, just pelting of these horrible stories, each one seemingly worse than the last, seemingly more complicated. And, you know, I've had a particularly difficult time, and it's just been very hard for me to get back on this horse. But, you know, we press on and we keep faith, even when it kind of hurts a lot to do so.
You have one unheard message.
Hey, Devin, I'm just calling to let you know that I got these sheets, the Brooklinen sheets that they sent over, and I fucking love them, okay? They're fucking amazing. I'm on my way to class right now, but last night I had the best sleep of my life. Because Berkeley has weird weather, okay? Sometimes it's really cold at night, sometimes it's really hot. And for some reason, I can sleep on these sheets without putting the heating in my house or putting on the fan. I don't know what magic it is. I don't understand the magic of this duvet cover, but it's magical. So just want to let you know that I probably need the code to order some more sheets.
Varsha's right. These sheets are incredible. And brooklinen.com is giving an exclusive offer just to Hellions. Get $20 off and free shipping when you use promo code Hellbent at brooklinen.com. Brooklinen is so sure you'll love your new sheets, they offer a risk-free 60-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all of their sheets and comforters. So the only way to get $20 off and free shipping is to use promo code Hellbent at brooklinen.com. That's brooklinen.com, promo code Hellbent. These really are the best sheets ever.
So What's the most recent update with the kids at the border?
So this story was like a punch in the gut, because just when you think that maybe this story is not improving, it's never improved, but, you know, maybe stagnating a little bit, it gets worse. The New York Times reported that in shelters all over the country, hundreds of migrant children have been woken up in the middle of the night, loaded onto buses, and sent to a tent city in West Texas. So here's the thing. Undocumented children being held by ICE or Federal Immigration or ORR had been in private homes, foster home shelters, you know, grouped in rooms of two or three. You know, they were kind of being cared for in small groups. They went to school. They had visits with legal representation and, you know, social workers. And it was more like the traditional foster system as we understand it, or at least as I understand it from my many years of watching Law & Order SVU, which I can admit that's about as much information I know about how the foster system works. But now what they're doing is sending these kids to these massive tent cities in Texas. And Texas is not a great place for a tent city. It's not like a temperate, beautiful place to set up a campsite indefinitely.
Yeah. And I mean, nowhere is a good place for a tent city.
But nowhere is good to do that. But West Texas is particularly shitty to do that.
Yeah.
And they're being grouped by, you know, they're being put in groups of 20. They're lining up in bunk after bunk. There's no school. They're not being sent to school. They're given workbooks that aren't checked, which is like, I can't even fathom who thought replacing school with workbooks that aren't checked. First, replacing school with anything except school is absolute nonsense.
Yeah.
And then, but not even putting in place a program to at least do some sort of ongoing tutoring or educational check-in is bullshit. They're also not getting the same access to legal representation. It's a nightmare. This is an actual nightmare. This is actually my worst nightmare.
Yeah.
And I, you know, and again, it's so hard to say that because there is so much going on that is such a nightmare for so many people, sexual assault survivors, you know, people who depend on the ACA, Muslims who are subject to scrutiny and travel ban, people who are being looked at and may possibly lose their green cards. I mean, there is no shortage of shit. But for me, this was the story that broke me. This was the story that just completely decimated any faith that I might have had left in not the Trump administration, because I really wasn't holding my breath, but in the underlying support structure of an agency like HHS. Because regardless of who's at the top, who is the secretary of that, I thought that there would be mechanisms in place to prevent bullshit like this.
Yeah.
And I that was naive. And I realized that was naive. And that was something I was telling myself so I could sleep at night. And that is a part of this long pattern of privileged white women not seeing what they don't want to see. And, you know, this story, again, it pains me to say that it took 2 years into the Trump administration and all of this bullshit for there to be a story that finally got me to strip the cloth away from my eyes and understand that there is no underlying structure for our most vulnerable populations and for our most vulnerable children in this country. It's an embarrassing thing to admit, but this tent city is in response to more than 13,000 detained migrant children. They're trying to figure out what to do with them. Because we have 13,000 children, people's children, people's babies in custody because they are brown, because we have deemed them not worthy of the sort of affection that we normally reserved for children, which shouldn't surprise me. It shouldn't surprise anyone. Republicans took 9 months to renew CHIP. The C in CHIP stands for children. I feel like I said that about 1,000 fucking times. But if we, I mean, so why would we take care of migrant children? We are not even interested in taking care of American citizen children.
Yeah.
And there are 13,000 kids, and now they're being shipped into tents and denied access to school and legal representation. And when you group kids together like that with these huge numbers, do you know why there are standards in public schools for a teacher to child ratio? You know, depending on the district, it can be, you know, 1 to 12, 1 to 20, what you can debate what the best number is, but there always is a ratio cap. And that is because to take care of children, they need a certain amount of attention. And when you put them in huge shelters like this, and these children are hurting, they're traumatized, they don't have their parents, and you expect, you can't take care of these kids like this. And we're not trying to. That's the point. We're not trying to take care of them. And in the last year, the average length of time that migrant children spend in custody has gone from about 34 to 59 days. And we're just not trying. And this is just so reminiscent of something like the Japanese internment camps, which are a part of our own American history. And, you know, shockingly familiar to the idea of that you can just put people somewhere and forget about them, that you can just put kids somewhere and forget about them and wash your hands of them.
I think what really bothers me is that it really, like, there was a lot of pushback to, like, a couple of people were using the term ethnic cleansing, and there's a lot of rightful pushback to using that term because this may not be considered the legal definition of ethnic cleansing. It may not rise to that like level, right? But the thing is, like, ethnic cleansing doesn't happen in like one day. The government doesn't just decide one day, let's just like remove all these people and like totally displace them and stuff like that. And, you know, you can argue that this, because these are migrants, you're not technically displacing them and stuff like that. But the thing is, it is. In my head, it is. And you can disagree. Reasonable people can disagree. But in my head, it's important to call it that because it is only happening to a certain type of child, to a certain type of person. It is only happening to a certain category of children. It is systematic. It is clear. Right. We didn't talk about this last week, but last week there was a report that they found the memo from DHS where there was actually a memo defining the child separation policy. So DHS, Kirstjen Nielsen, when she was in front of the House, she lied and said there was no policy. Right. She was lying. Right. This is a systematic policy that has been created to house these people. And what's really like gross about it is that the New York Times reported it as if, like, you know, it's happening in the dead of night. The Trump administration is trying to hide it from you. But really, they don't care if you find out. They don't give a fuck. They really don't care. They have no shame in what they are doing. There's no longer any shame, right? And I think that's what really bothered me about this, is that, like, at the very least, and it is not a lot, what you can say of the Obama administration and the Bush administration and the Clinton administration, when they had to house unauthorized migrant children, there was a little shame. There was a little courtesy, a teeny tiny bit. There was still like a lot of injustice, but there was at least a little shame in the fact that, no, you can't treat these people like trash. They are still human beings, right? And I think what really bothered me about this is that this story came and went. There's no, like, unlike the family separation policy, because this has like sort of been like reported so many times, and because most of these kids are probably the kids that aren't actually separated, right? Some of these kids might be the ones that are coming across alone, or they're quote unquote unaccompanied, right? Like there could be, they could be actually unaccompanied or they could be separated. But because all of that has been reported already, because there's been enough, quote unquote, enough cable news on it, the story has just come and gone. And like, yes, it's on every, you know, newsletter that you read. And yes, you read it in the New York Times, but that's it. I didn't see any politician tweeting about it. I didn't see like Senators Harris, Feinstein, or Senator Cornyn, or Senator Cruz, or anyone giving a shit about this, right? And I know the Democratic senators probably do. I know they do. But there's nothing to do. I think the reason I feel so bothered is I feel so helpless because I can't just break all these kids out. You know, I really want to. I really want to go to Tornillo and just be like, fuck it, let's open the door and like break these kids out. But you can't. They've created this massive operation to house almost 13,000 children. I don't know what they're going to do with them. It doesn't make sense to me logically. Like, why are you spending so much money doing this? Just give them ankle bracelets and let them come back for their court date or figure out a way to deport them because that's what you really, really fucking want. Like, I don't understand why you are wasting so much money because you purport to be Republican to basically like traumatize children.
Which is why it's so clear to me that this isn't about immigration. And this isn't about anything except this sort of, I don't know, quasi-ethnic cleansing, or some sort of attempt to make a monolith state.
Yeah.
And to really, really push this home, I'm going to read a quote from the New York Times article. Like you said, Varsha, this story came and went, so I need as many people as possible to hear this. The article states, quote, "The children wore belts etched in pen with phone numbers for their emergency contacts. One young boy asked the shelter worker if he would be taken care of in Texas. The shelter worker replied that he would and told him that by moving, he was making space for other children like him who were stuck at the border and needed a place to live." This was at a Midwestern shelter where they had given the kids a couple of hours notice so that they wouldn't try to flee or panic.
This literally, this literally sounds like dystopian novels you read about, like future ethnic cleansings, or yeah, actual history books you read about ethnic cleansing, or literal like stories you read about ethnic cleansing. Like, I understand that there may be like German historians out there, Eastern European historians out there listening to this being like, no, Varsha, you're wrong. And I'm like, no, man, I've read historical novels about slavery, about family separation. I've read actual primary sources about slavery and family separation. This is what it looks like. It fucking looks like this. It really fucking does. Because you have certain staff members at certain shelters across the country that feel remorse and are leaking to the New York Times about how horrific this is. And this happened throughout history. There were people in all of these situations throughout history where kids were being basically, you know, brutalized or set up for something horrible or rounded up or whatever. And there were people who empathized and told the story about how horrific this was. There were people during Japanese internment, during Native American removal, during slavery, that told stories of like this, about how they empathize and how horrific this was. And that's what it feels like reading this. It feels like I am reading some dystopian novel or literally like a New York Times article from like 1850.
Right. Well, and right down to this gentle explanation to make this young boy, like, I don't know that I want to know how old he is, but saying he was, quote, making space for other children like him who were stuck at the border and needed a place to live. That reminded me of the scene in The Giver where the main character's dad was the doctor in this dystopian town. And he told his son that when twins are born, they send one twin off to live in another city or town because we don't need two of the exact same person. So one is moved to another town. And the kid learns later that what actually happens is his father, the doctor, basically takes the twins and weighs and measures them, and the one that's slightly smaller gets euthanized. And that this shelter worker telling him that by leaving he's helping other children reminded me of that gentle explanation that this doctor had given his son about what happens to the other twin.
I mean, I think what's really frustrating about this is that, you know, we talked about how most of these kids are probably the unaccompanied minors that come across the border alone, right? But the thing is, in previous administrations, a lot of these unaccompanied minors end up getting sponsors. But the New York Times article says that the number of detained migrant children has spiked, even though monthly border crossings have remained relatively unchanged. And this is because of harsh rhetoric and policies in, by the Trump administration, but this harsh rhetoric and policies have actually made it harder to place children with sponsors. Because as we've talked ad nauseum on this podcast, a lot of times these sponsors are immigrants themselves, authorized or unauthorized. And the Trump administration isn't a fan of immigrants. Like literally just like minutes before we're recording, it was reported that Stephen Miller tried to convince the Trump administration or Trump to deny visas to all Chinese students, right? And that's totally different from this issue of migrant children. But this really isn't about fucking immigration, right? Because if it was about fucking immigration, they would let these children go to their sponsors, you know, put an ankle bracelet on them and say, okay, you're back for your court date in 2 weeks. You're going to be deported. Like that itself is a horrific policy to deport children back to countries where they don't want to live because it's dangerous. But just housing them in a random tent in Texas with no schooling, with no legal support, with no mental support, medical support maybe, right? Or emotional support. Like we've talked about, like if some of these kids are young kids, like under, you know, 10, we've talked about how, you know, even a month or two can totally traumatize these children for the rest of their lives.
Right. Right. And there's also reports of abuse, not enough food, not caring for these kids. I mean, it is so deeply shameful that this is where we are. And I know this sounds a little conspiracy theorist of me, but I also would like to remind everyone that these are considered most of them are considered unaccompanied minors. But remember that when kids were separated from their families, they were then reclassified as unaccompanied minors.
So we don't actually know how many of these kids have parents out there.
We don't actually know.
Right? We don't know.
Right.
And also, there could be a case where even the actual unaccompanied minors have totally fine and safe sponsors who are living in the United States who can take care of these kids, but instead the Trump administration is making it harder for them to get sponsors. Like that is something that I don't think is a conspiracy theory for me. Like I think that is true, that the Trump administration is willing to not allow some of these kids to go with their sponsors because they don't fucking feel like it. Like it's horrific, right? And I think like there's so many levels of the horrifyingness, right? We talked about like a little bit over a month ago about how a lot of these kids have to appear in immigration court alone. And there are like, this is continuing to happen where like, you know, they have to appear before court in like video conference and they have to plead their case in front of like, there's not even a real judge in front of you. Like, you can't even have that kind of like emotional connection to an immigration judge. It's so like, again, like I don't like making bad historical analogies. I talked to Dr. Nicole Hemmer just about this. It's about historical analysis, right? But when you talk about the slave trade in the United States, the process of enslaving Africans, right? The one thing you teach your students, the one thing that you learn when you're learning the history of this is the commodification. And I understand that we're not actually, you know, selling these children into slavery or anything, but the dehumanization is intentional for me. I see it as intentional, right? And I see it as a longer process than just the Trump administration. I feel like immigration court itself is a dehumanizing process. But by stuffing thousands of kids into a tent city, right, where you don't know if there might be one child struggling because you don't maybe not have enough workers. You don't know if every single child is getting the mental, emotional support you need. You don't even know if every child is getting the legal support they need. It is a dehumanizing process. And I think that is intentional. And that is why I think it is okay to say this is like a possible step in an ethnic cleansing. I think it can be stopped, obviously, because we're not getting to the really horrific, really, really horrific part yet. We're already almost at a pretty horrific state, right? But I think, like, when you look at this as a whole, you're seeing the dehumanization of a mass number of children because of their skin color. And it's through a variety of ways. And I think the first way is what, Devin, what you talked about, is the process of, like, classifying them as unaccompanied minors.
Hellions, we are in the sprint portion of this election cycle. The 2018 midterms are about 35 days away, and it all hinges on the House. If progressive candidates win in just 23 swing districts on November 6th, we can take back a majority in the House of Representatives and maybe actually put a check on President Trump and force conservatives to do their jobs. That's why nearly 500,000 people have signed up to volunteer with Swing Left. When you join Swing Left at swingleft.org/hellbent, you'll be immediately connected with other volunteers in your area who are working to win the race in a nearby swing district. You'll find out where and how you can make the most impact on flipping the House starting right now. It's really that simple. You have to get involved. Each of us has to get involved. Democracy is a contact sport. Now is the time to save it. We have to work to take back the House. So don't just vote this year. Volunteer. Join the grassroots movement that's making change in this year's midterm elections. So sign up now at swingleft.org/hellbent. As if that last section wasn't bad enough, can you tell us a little bit about what's going on with the Kavanaugh hearings and what kind of the new development?
Yeah. So if you subscribe to us on Patreon, you probably know we released an episode about Jeff Flake and what he did on Friday with the FBI investigation and how we have one more week for the FBI to complete its investigation. But what we've learned this whole weekend is that the White House is most likely restricting the scope of that investigation. It's already restricted in the fact that you only have a week to conduct an FBI investigation.
It's such bullshit.
Because I think, like, you know, you could argue, oh, the Anita Hill investigation only took 3 days. But that was because, like, it was like a normal process. And the FBI was like, oh, yeah, sure. We only need 3 days to do this, right? But this is being restricted by time first. And then on another level by scope, right? Because as of this taping, Christine Blasey Ford has not talked to the FBI. What the fuck? Yeah. Right? And there was a really, really amazing and depressing Jane Meyer story over the weekend about how it's really hard for people who have information about Kavanaugh, who are involved in this investigation, such as Ford and others, and classmates of Kavanaugh, have not been able to get in touch with the FBI. The FBI have not gotten in touch with them, and they're being redirected to, like, the fucking tip line, right? But specifically, I want to talk about this one story that came out today about how before the second allegation, Deborah Ramirez's allegation about how Kavanaugh exposed himself to her at a party, Brett Kavanaugh and his team were communicating behind the scenes with friends to refute the claim before the fucking story was released. I wonder why an innocent person is talking to his friends about, like, being his character witness before these stories are even released. Like, how did he know this story was going to be released? Like, how... like, what the fuck, right? So basically, these texts, yeah.
Well, and just not to put too fine a point on it, because I feel like we covered the Kavanaugh's a lying fuckhead pretty well. But Shannon Coulter tweeted, quote, Kavanaugh has said under oath the first time he heard of the Deborah Ramirez's allegations was a 923 New Yorker article.
Liar. He is a liar. So basically,
under oath, that's a fucking crime.
I wish I had the energy to count the number of lies he said in both hearings, but I do not have that energy. I really care about our country, but I don't care that much to count the lies. Watch those two hearings again and count the fucking lies, because there's a lot of fucking lies. So basically, Carrie Burcham, who is a classmate with Kavanaugh, and Deborah Ramirez have tried to get these messages to the FBI. Basically, these are text messages between Burcham and Karen Yaroslavich, who are both friends of Kavanaugh. And basically, these messages suggest that the nominee, that Kavanaugh was personally talking with former classmates about Ramirez's story in advance of the NARCA article, before it was fucking released, and saying, hey, can you, Yaroslavich, can you go on like the record in my defense? And so I don't understand why an innocent person who just likes beer, doesn't rape people on his calendar, is like,
beer! Beer! Beer!
I was watching like all the late night hosts and their takes on the Kavanaugh hearings, and all of them like landed on that one section where like somebody asked, I forget who it was, which senator it was, but asked him about beer, and he just said, I like beer, like 15 times in 10 seconds.
I like beer. I like
what
beer.
Is happening? Right. But basically, this motherfucker is totally not credible. Right. So at this point, I do not understand how you can confirm him. I understand why like assholes like Ted Cruz and Lindsey Graham are going to vote for him, but I don't understand how Murkowski, Collins, and Flake can vote to confirm. And I just want to point out that another development today, because of how, you know, Jeff Flake is on like a fucking like hero high or something, he was on 60 Minutes on Sunday.
Which, by the way, that's why he did this, is because he wanted to be on 60 Minutes. I'm sorry for interrupting. I just wanted to, you know, throw that out into the ether.
I thank him for his attempt to extend this by a week. I thank him for that effort, right? I'm like, okay, fine. You know, Senator Coons, Senator Flake, you did your jobs. The bare minimum, Senator Flake, but okay, right? Because you still voted the guy out of committee. But it really bothers me that you're just milking this for all it can get. Like, I get it. You want a book deal. You want to be on MSNBC for the rest of your life. You want to teach at some Republican college or something after you leave the Senate. But like, these are people's lives. Did those two women who confronted in the elevator like mean nothing? Like, these are people's lives. But back to like Jeff Flake on Sunday, he basically said, like, they asked him, you know, if you find out that he lied to the committee, are you like, is that disqualifying? And he said, oh, yes. Right. And so there's two ways you can think of that. Like, is it disqualifying if he lied about the Ford attack, or is it disqualifying if he lied at all? And knowing Flake, he probably just means about the Ford attack. But the problem that I'm having right now is that this FBI investigation is so limited in scope that they're just using it as a fucking cover to vote for the guy. Right. That's what they're doing. Yeah. And it's so clear that that's what they're doing. That all you have to do is like watch a Trump press conference, like either the one that was last week before the FBI investigation was launched, or the one today, right? Today, as in October 1st. Like, you just have to watch them and realize he doesn't give a fuck about like letting the FBI do its actual job. He's just doing whatever the Federalist Society tells him he has to do to get Kavanaugh confirmed and to eventually get reelected. Like, it's all he's doing, right? And so,
look, Trump. Trump, I these press conferences were something real
and
special.
And I fucking hate the word freewheeling. A lot of like media outlets are like, their headline is Trump's freewheeling press conference. No,
that was not freewheeling. That was unfucking hinged.
As we've said, we don't like the word crazy on this podcast, but it really was bananas. It really was.
It was out of control bananas. I have never seen anything quite like it. I mean, just the things he was saying to defend Kavanaugh. He went on a whole rant about how first off, Trump saying that he understands what Kavanaugh is going through because he's also been, quote, falsely accused, is so close to getting the point. It's almost laughable. It's so close to describing exactly what the problem is with no self-awareness whatsoever that it's almost a parody of itself.
Today's press conference, he was also asked, like, you know, if Kavanaugh lied about his drinking, is that disqualified? And Trump was like, no, I don't think he lied. And then he was like, went on to say, I can honestly say I've never had a beer in my life, you know? And then he goes, it's one of my only good traits. I do not drink. And I was like, that is so close to being self-aware. That is self-aware. And then he says, can you imagine if I had, what a mess I would be? And I was just like, wait, but that means you already know that you're a mess. And being drunk would make you more of a mess.
Right. I mean, but that's the thing. It is. I've been left 100% speechless by everything that's happened with this Kavanaugh hearing. Again, Trump being so close to the point and missing it so thoroughly, it's not an accident. It goes back. I swear to God, I'm just going to change my name to, I was talking to Sarah Kendzior about authoritarianism, but when I was talking to her about it, and again, the blatancy is what's so key here, is because it's not an accident that he almost gets the point. It's not an accident that he brings up the fact that he's also been accused of sexual abuse and sexual assault, because that's the fucking point. Is that we are being dominated by men who have not just mistreated women or disrespected them or don't think they should be in government, but these are men who are sexually violent and are use women's bodies in the most disgusting performance of masculinity. That's the fucking point.
At the UN conference, they asked him about Roy Moore, right? They asked him, like, you know, why do you always side with the accused and not the accusers? And then he, like, gaslit us by saying, I wasn't happy with Roy Moore. You fucking endorsed the asshole and you defended him after these allegations came out. Like, what the fuck? Like, you know, like birds of a feather, like, flock together. That's how you explain sexual predators in 2018. They all fucking hang out in a club. Whether or not they are on the same political spectrum, they're all like in it together. They're all in this giant fucking like cesspool. And if you think about it, it's almost every single person who like had like this quote unquote pristine or almost pristine reputation before Trump has come out as like being like a total sex creep. Rob Porter, Roy Moore, like Roy Moore wasn't great beforehand, but at least like no one had found out he was a fucking pedophile until Trump. Like, Jesus Christ. There was this, we didn't even talk about this, but Justin Miller, who was an advisor on Trump's campaign, basically tried to actually, no, he did. He dosed his girlfriend with an abortion pill after she said she didn't want to get an abortion, I think, or after he was afraid that she was pregnant. And I'm like, what the actual fuck? People are dosing women now? So, yeah, I think my real issue with the press conferences is that I have to like really make sure I'm paying attention to the fact that he's just gaslighting us every fucking day about all of this shit.
Just the fact that he had a press conference is gaslighting in and of itself, because he hasn't given two press conferences in the entire time he's been president. Because he knows right now the focus isn't on him.
He really, okay, it's two things. He wants the focus on him to take the focus off of Kavanaugh, but also he's just such a fucking narcissist that he really just wants the focus on him, right? Because today's press conference was about trade. He had a press conference for how amazing it was today, and ABC Cecilia Vega gets picked for the first question of the news conference. This is like when they're still talking about trade. And Trump is like, she's shocked that I picked her. She's in a state of shock. And Vega's like, no, I'm not. Thank you, Mr. President. And he's like, that's okay. I know you're not thinking. You never do. And like, I'm like, what the fuck? And this is like not the first time in this one press conference he interrupts or insults women. Because later there's he's called like Katie Turr, Little Katie. He's been doing this for like years now. He's called Maureen Dowd crazy, and so like he does this to women during press conferences specifically, and it's really fucked up. Other female reporters tried to ask him about the FBI investigation into Kavanaugh, and they were like, and Trump was like, no, you're done, and he just kept interrupting people. It's incredibly offensive. People think that like, oh, like these are the small things that he does that are like, you know, this is not important in the big scheme of things. It actually really is, right? When you think of how dictators treat journalists, they look to the United States. Because if the United States is treating journalists well, other countries that treat journalists well will pressure dictators and authoritarian countries to treat journalists well, right? But when one of the oldest democracies in the world and one of the oldest places where free press has existed is treating its reporters like shit, where the president of the free fucking world is treating their reporters like shit, what do you think Putin is going to do? What do you think, you know, Kim Jong-un is going to do? Or what do you think, you know, reporters who are arrested in Myanmar are going to do? Who are they going to look to, right? We didn't talk about this story, but a couple of weeks ago, two Reuters reporters were arrested and sentenced to, like, I think 7 years in jail in Myanmar because they were basically, like, framed for violating national security in Burma. And what they were doing is reporting on the genocide of the Rohingya, right? It's so important to look at every single time Trump demeans a reporter and when he demeans a woman, right? Because it's two things that are happening. One, he's being a sexist-ass, like, pig, and it's disgusting that a president does this on a daily fucking basis. And two, he's demeaning the free press. And it's really important, right? It's really important to look at how Kavanaugh starts his, like, his hearing on Thursday by saying this is all a giant con job, and Trump continues to call the press, like, loco, right? It's really important to look at language and how the language has fundamentally changed, right? Because obviously everyone in 1991 is shocked when Clarence Thomas calls what's happening to him a high-tech lynching. But, like, Kavanaugh went even further than just saying high-tech lynching, right? He basically said, I am going to go on a policy of revenge if I'm confirmed. Not just if I'm confirmed, when I'm confirmed, fuck you, fuck the ACLU, fuck the Clintons, and fuck everybody. I am going to prove to you that I'm a partisan, right? And he does this because there was actually reports after that Fox News interview he gave with his wife that, like, Trump didn't like the fact that he wasn't more angry. The little shitty things that Trump does during press conferences are actually very important in trying to understand how the whole discourse around everything has changed. And, like, you know, pundits like to talk about the Overton window. The Overton window on how we can talk to reporters and other congressmen and about other congressmen and about people has shifted so far off the rails. And yeah, it's partly because of Trump, and it's really fucked up.
Fish rots from the head. So when the president acts like this, everyone else does.
Because, like,
too.
You know, Lindsey Graham wouldn't be talking like this if it was, like, any other president.
I almost expected him to call him K-Dog and invite him out for a beer right then. I mean, come the fuck on. There's no way he would have done that if Trump were the president. And that's why it's important how he speaks to the press. That's why it's important how he speaks to other women. And just the implication that these shitty little things should be let go because we've got bigger fucking problems is why that story about the kids who are being shipped to tent cities has gotten no traction, because we have been told that this is a zero sum game, and it's not. Okay, Varsha, who is the dickwad of the week?
It is none other than Uncle Joe, former Vice President Joe Biden.
The next person who tells me that Joe Biden should run for office in 2020. I swear to God, I'm going to just, like, fart in their face and run away, because I have no other method of dealing with people who think Joe Biden should run in 2020. I'm a mature adult, by the way. Capital M, capital A.
No, you definitely are. That is the mature reaction to say when a white man tells you, I think Joe Biden could really win in 2020 against Trump. He has it all, right? Farting in their face and running away is the mature reaction to that. It's Varsha endorsed. Trust me, right? So, like, Joe Biden, like, even though he should always be quiet, this week he should have been, like, particularly quiet, right, this past week. Apparently, like, he's, like, complained to fellow Democrats that they're all judging his role in the Anita Hill hearings, and they're not taking into account the limits of his power as a committee chairman and the political reality of the moment. And I'm like, yeah, the political reality of the moment was that all men were really shitty to women and didn't understand what sexual harassment was. And the culture itself was even more misogynistic, if you can think of it, than it is today. And you were a part of it, man. That's what they're judging you for.
Here's the fucking problem. Republican senators who are going after a sexual assault survivor, we're quoting Joe fucking Biden. He could be the dickwad of the week just based on that fact alone. But no. He had to go above and beyond, because mediocre white men really know how to fail up.
And it also, they really know how to make it about them, right? When you see Avenatti talking about how Democrats are shit, it's all about him, right? When you see, like, Trump talking about something else, it's all about him. Like, it's always about them. Like, Kavanaugh, everything was about me, me, me. Lindsey Graham, it's all about me. Jeff Flake, it's all about me, right? But specifically Joe Biden in this case, how he made it about him was he said, apparently privately, this is, like, not a direct quote, it's on background, but privately, Biden has also described it as unfair that Ms. Hill continues to hold him responsible for her rough treatment in the Senate. You were the fucking committee chairman, you fucking...
I will hold Chuck Grassley accountable for what happened to Dr. Ford for the rest of time. Period. Period. And Joe Biden has to take that burden for Anita Hill because fuck you, Joe Biden. Like, what do you mean it's unfair? You know what's unfair? That Brett Kavanaugh is even being considered to be a Supreme Court justice when three women have come forward and credibly accused him of sexual misconduct. You know what's unfair?
Joe Biden is like, I don't know if you probably remember this, Devin, but he had like a lot of like creepy, touchy moments when he was vice president. You probably remember. It was creepy, right? And people like shrugged it away and they shouldn't have. I'm still creeped out about it. I get goosebumps every time, like the bad kind of goosebumps. Since like this Kavanaugh stuff and since the Me Too moment, like has Me Too movement has begun, like Joe Biden has like tried to sneak in statements about how he would have done things differently, but he hasn't apologized. Okay, he hasn't actually apologized because apologizing, just like if Kavanaugh had just fucking apologized, would mean taking responsibility. And Joe Biden thinks he's entitled to be a respected former vice president and to be the basic assumed nominee in 2020 or the assumed front runner. And he doesn't like it when he's not getting what he's entitled to. And he thinks Anita Hill is standing in his fucking way. And I'm like, no. You're standing in your own fucking way because apparently you think that just shrugging off Anita Hill's testimony and shrugging off what you did to her and other Judiciary Committee Democrats and Judiciary Committee Republicans did to her in 1991 is nothing. You think people should just fucking get over it? No, you know why? Women will not fucking get over it.
The thing about Joe Biden is that I think part of what he thinks here, and I'm just spitballing at this point, but part of what I think he thinks is that there are people who have sinned far worse than him. Well, and that is absolutely true. But the sins of those people do not wash you clean of yours.
It's the same thing with Al Franken, too, right? Because I think when Al Franken was resigning, right, he gives that big fiery speech about how he's like, this is really ironic that I'm the one leaving the Senate when like Donald Trump has been accused 16 times. I'm like, yeah, it's not ironic. It's called like justice. It's called like fucking like how things should run. You should be out of the Senate and Trump should not be the president. Like Joe Biden, like you shouldn't, like you should actually apologize for Anita Hill if you want to run in 2020. You should actually confront what you did. You should actually like try to be self-reflective because this is what I really dislike about a lot of politicians, Democrat and Republican, is that they can, because as we've talked about, because they're all a little bit narcissistic or a lot narcissistic, they can never admit a fault. And it's human to admit a fault.
All right, Varsha, last but not least, a few action items that you Hellions can do after you listen to the show. So first thing I want to stress is that you can continue to donate to Racist Texas. They are doing that legal work on the ground. They are the ones that are the front line of defense for protecting these kids from what is going on in Texas right now.
Yeah. And if you have the time after you've donated to Racist, also just call your congressperson and tell them to hold a hearing on this because this is fucked up shit. This is really fucked up shit. And you really just got to continue to be angry about this. I know people are despairing. But the second action item is to continue to call your senators and tell them to vote no on Kavanaugh. Even if your senators are like in a dark, even if you're in a dark red state, call your senator, right? Especially if you're in Maine, Alaska, or Arizona, call your senators.
Yeah, and if you have a Manchin as your senator, call him too and let him have it.
Yeah.
Just like all over his voicemail, just let him have it.
Yeah, because even when Joe Donnelly from Indiana, Mike Pence's state, can say, fuck this, I'm not voting for Kavanaugh, Joe Manchin, what the fuck are you doing?
What the fuck are you doing, Joe Manchin? Get your fucking life together. So, and then after you've done that, also donate to RAIN. NARAL, Planned Parenthood, any organization that supports survivors of sexual assault and sexual abuse, because especially in this moment right now, survivors of sexual assault and harassment and abuse are feeling very vulnerable. And these kind of groups do the work that we need to support these women and make and really start to reckon with the sexual assault crisis we have in this country.
Yeah. Apparently during the Kavanaugh hearings, like the percentage increase calls to the national sexual assault hotline, like increased by like 200% or something. Those hearings were really, really impactful in a lot of us. And so your dollars are really well spent. It's Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. And they're a nonprofit and they're anti-sexual assault organization. They're the largest in the United States. They support these survivors, and it's really important to support them. And so after you've called your senators and told them to vote no on Kavanaugh, after you donate to Racist Texas, you should donate to RAIN, or you should donate to a pro-abortion group. Whatever you choose.
So, Hallians, thank you so much for listening. This was a really tough episode for me personally. And although I'm not going to lie, my rage is coming back a little bit. Just working through this kind of stuff with all of you. I mean, this is what keeps me going. This is what keeps the rage going. And this is what is going to affect change. So Thank you. Thank you all, not just for listening, but being part of this community and doing the hard work that is necessary to combat this political moment in which sexual abusers are put on pedestals and children are being put in cages and tent cities. And we're going to get through it because we're going to change it together.
Yeah. 35 days to the midterms, guys.
35 days to the midterms. Get your butt in gear. It's the last stretch. We're almost there. Varsha and I will be back here on Thursday. In the meantime, have a great week, raise some hell, and remember to practice some compassion. Hellbent Podcast is a production of Hellbent Media. It is produced by me, Devin Handy.
And Varsha Venkata Subramanian.
We get editing help from Andrew Walsh. And we, of course, take input from co-creator Sarah Lerner.
You can follow us on social media at Hellbent Pod on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook.
And you can join our Facebook group, Dickwads Be Gone, at facebook.com/groups/dickwadsbegone.
You can follow me on Twitter at @Varsha_Venkat.
And you can follow me at Devin Handy. Also, remember to subscribe and rate us on iTunes and rate us 5 stars, because that's just the rules of feminism. Tune in every Monday and Thursday for an intersectional feminist look and the centering of women's voices and people of color. We look at current events, public policy, and upcoming elections to give you the most incisive look into stories that don't get covered elsewhere. Thank you.